Hi, and welcome back to the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network. I'm your host, Bruce Hood, and I'm pleased to say that we're joined today by an extra special guest, Rich Pankos. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Bruce. Good to be here.
Great. Now, Rich, tell me, you're at the University of Bristol, but what's your position here?
Right. Well, my day job is being a biogeochemist, studying how the Earth works. I sit over in chemistry, but I'm a geologist by background. My other position is being director of the University of Bristol Cabot Institute, which is a multidisciplinary institute that studies all the ways that we live on, depend on, and affect our planet.
That sort of experience is going to be really useful today because I've chosen three podcasts, well, recordings, mm-hmm. that all address issues of climate change to some extent. So you're the perfect person to provide some comment on that.
Fantastic. And of course, we love the diversity of work going around here. Climate change is a really broad problem. It affects everything from our weather, but also our food and infrastructure. So there's a lot to explore. So I'm quite interested and excited to hear about the three talks.
Okay, so let's start up. First up, we have Gemma Rowlandson from the University of Bath. And I'm just going to load up her talk here.
In an old-fashioned village near Rotterdam, Lordy, oh, lady, oh, dear, there's a sweet little Dutch girl called Mary Ann, Lordy, oh, lady, Lord, oh, and she wears wooden shoes on it.
One of the biggest problems in the world today is that not everyone has access to clean and safe drinking water, and this is only going to get worse because we keep putting more toxins and chemicals into our water supply. But there's one material that we could use to stop this, one that could help us save the world, and one that looks very much like Leerdammer cheese. Okay, so it's not yellow, and I wouldn't eat it, but just like Leerdammer, this material is full of holes, and it's these holes which give it world-saving potential, because these holes can actually pull toxins back out of the water. Material is known as an activated carbon, and this is what I researched for my PhD. Now, activated carbons are actually really easy to make. You can start from almost anything, but I like to use the stuff that no one really wants anymore. So I use plant waste. All you do is you take the plant waste and heat it up, and this turns into carbon. Now, carbon is just the black stuff that you get on burnt toast. At this point, there are no holes in it, so we can't use it to save the world just yet. What I have to do is I heat up again to a higher temperature, and I also pass a gas through it. And as this gas travels through my material, it creates these long channels and pores, and these are our holes. But how do they work? How do they pull toxins out of the water? Well, there's one really important thing that you need to know about toxins, and that is toxins love to stick to surfaces. Seriously, they'll just be swimming around, minding their own business, and then suddenly, they'll see a surface, and they just can't stop themselves. They see the surface, they stick. Now, this is really, really handy. Because toxins love to stick to surfaces, it means that we can store them there, removing them from the water. And our Leerdammer cheese carbons are so good at this, because they've got so many holes, it gives them a massive surface area. The more surface area you have, the more toxins that you can stick to it. But now, there are some toxins that are actually quite tricky to remove from the water. And this is what my PhD really focuses on. I'm changing the size and the shape of the holes in my Leerdammer cheese-like carbons to selectively target these tricky toxins and remove them from the water supply. So in my PhD, I'm using a waste that no one wants. I'm upgrading it into activated carbon, and I'm using this Leerdammer cheese-like material to target tricky toxins and save the world.
That was Gemma Rowlandson from the University of Bath. Now, Rich, that sounded really quite incredible. Is she onto something here?
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love it. Well, I mean, well, if nothing else, she's got a fantastic analogy, doesn't she?
Yeah.
So many of us who are involved with environmental challenges study the challenge, this problem. We measure the pollution. We measure climate change. And it's just so exciting to see young people pivoting around to study solutions. So what jumped out at me, two really exciting things about that solution. Mm-hmm. One, she's using waste product to come up with it, right? That's what we want. You know, she's basically taking something that would be a problem,
yep,
landfill waste, and turn it into a solution. The other thing that really jumped out at me is the huge variety of toxins that go in the environment. And she's come up with something that's really quite flexible, quite adroit. You can imagine she can use somewhat different surfaces, different shapes to these pores, and yeah, and tailor it for all sorts of different challenges. And that type of flexibility is going to be really useful going ahead.
Well, that looks like a bright future for that particular project. But I'm now going to turn to something which is probably quite familiar with you. I think it might be one of your ex-students.
Ah.
But we're going to next hear from Leanne Melbourne, who's going to be telling us about rhodoliths. Now, I didn't know what rhodoliths were, but listen to this wonderful explanation from Leanne.
My research focuses on the skeletal strength of rhodoliths around the UK and how climate change is affecting them. So what are rhodoliths? They are free-living, unattached forms of calcified seaweed. They have calcium carbonate within their cell walls, which gives them this hard, chalky-like appearance. So they're marine plants, seaweeds, that look like corals, but they are not corals. However, just like corals, they form complex habitats. So these rhodoliths interlock together, creating all these nooks and crannies and spaces, which are an ideal homes to a wide variety of organisms. This includes being a nursery ground to commercial species of scallops and fish. So if you like seafood, then these organisms are important. However, these organisms are highly sensitive to human stresses such as pollution and scallop dredging. Hence, they are protected under UK and EU law. And now climate change is seen as an additional stressor to these organisms. So climate change. We have increased in CO2 levels leading to warming, which we also see in the ocean. But the other big CO2 problem is ocean acidification. This is where dissolved CO2 changes the chemistry of the ocean, making it more acidic, and this affects how organisms function, and for calcifying organisms like rhodoliths and corals, how they calcify. So recently on the news, 93% of the corals on the Great Barrier Reef are bleached due to climate change. They have lost their vibrant colours as they have lost the algae within them. But in the case of rhodoliths, we see climate change is causing changes to their internal structure. When you compare the internal structure of rhodoliths grown in current CO2 levels with rhodoliths grown in CO2 levels predicted for the year 2050, you see that the increase in CO2 is causing the rhodoliths to form larger cells with thinner cell walls. But what does this do to their internal strength? Finite element analysis is a computer modelling package originally used in engineering to test the stress and strain buildup in bridges and planes. So we can now use this to test the internal stress of our rhodoliths. So if we model these structural changes using finite element analysis, what we see is that the larger, bigger cells and the thinner cell walls are causing the model to be more stressed and more prone to breakage. So an increase in CO2 levels, rhodoliths are forming weaker skeletons. They are less likely to create this 3D structure, which is so vital to creating these complex habitats. However, this is all based on rhodoliths grown for 3 months, short-term data. I'm currently comparing rhodoliths collected 100 years ago with rhodoliths of today to look at long-term effects of climate change on their skeletal strength, ultimately to infer how the future and how future climate change will affect the skeletal strength of rhodoliths and therefore their ability to continue to provide these complex habitats to a wide variety of organisms, including the ones on your plate.
That was Leanne Melbourne from the University of Bristol telling us about rhodoliths, which, in her words, are not coral. what did you think of that talk,
Rich? Well, I have to confess I'm a little bit biased. Leanne did her final year project with me over in the School of Chemistry. I would have loved to keep her as a PhD student, but she said, Rich, what you do, it's just not biological enough. I want to work with living things.
Right.
And so she went off to Earth Sciences and is working on this. But it is fantastic work. We've been grappling with this problem of ocean acidification for a long time. It's sort of the unspoken climate change or unspoken CO2 problem. It's gotten a lot of tension over the past couple of years. The global bleaching event that she alluded to is do more to temperature than ocean acidification, but it has shown the spotlight on things like the Great Barrier Reef.
Right.
What I love about her work is that she shows it's not just about the Great Barrier Reef. And that's a very visual example, but we depend upon these complex marine ecosystems in so many different ways. And and her story is sort of, you know, it alludes to the complexity of organisms. These organisms are not dying because of the ocean acidification. They're changing their cell structure, becoming a little more brittle, and therefore not a good enough substrate for a wider ecosystem to depend. A wider ecosystem that includes our shellfish and our fisheries might depend on.
That's it, isn't it? I mean, that's one of the things I don't think people really fully appreciate is the very sensitive balance that we have in our ecosystems, that, you know, just a slight change in the acidification of the ocean is something which could be catastrophe.
Absolutely. It's one of the, you know, when we think about things like climate change and ocean acidification, we know how the pH will change. We know with a fair degree of certainty how much warmer the world gets.
Yeah.
Big question is, how is that going to affect our ecosystems?
Yeah.
And with work that Leanne is doing, we're beginning to get our understanding of how organisms will respond. But then we still have to do this further work to figure out how an entire ecosystem will respond. So these are very, very, very complicated problems. And the only way we're going to grapple with them is probably not by just solving them in and of themselves, but people like Leanne who are going to be probing and identifying some of the unexpected consequences.
Right.
Because if they're unexpected, we won't be able to deal with them. If we at least have an idea of things that are coming, we can begin to adapt and plan.
That's great. Okay. Right. So for last contribution, we're going up to Durham, and we're going to listen to Jenny Horrocks about her research project.
"130,000 years ago, you'd have been sitting here surrounded by ice, several miles thick, that covered most of Europe and North America. But driven by natural change, the Earth was warming up. The ice was melting. The sea level was rising. The UK became so warm that hippos swam in the River Thames. Antarctica was 5 degrees warmer than it is today. But that's a temperature we will see again, maybe even in our lifetimes, if we continue to use fossil fuels. Antarctica contains enough ice to raise sea levels by 60 metres. So understanding how and how quickly the ice responded the last time the Earth was as warm as today is crucial to predict how it will respond to the future warming. I work with cores or cylinders of sediment drilled from the seabed. When we split the core open, we see it's made of these horizontal layers deposited through time of two main components. The first are microorganisms called algae. Algae photosynthesize. They require lots of sunlight in order to grow. But when the ocean's very cold, the surface of it freezes, forming sea ice, which can be several meters thick. This means the algae have very little access to sunlight, and hardly any of them can survive. However, when it's nice and warm like today, there's very little sea ice, and algae can thrive. Different species of algae are sensitive to different things. For example, some only survive in a very narrow temperature range, telling us exactly how warm the ocean was. The second main component of our cores is material ground out by the ice sheet. Beneath the ice on Antarctica is a continent twice the size of Australia. As ice moves, just like a river, it erodes the landscape below it. It carries all this rock and sand towards the ocean and dumps it as it melts. The more rock and sand we have in our cores, the more ice must have been melting. My research suggests that Antarctica started melting very quickly after temperatures began to rise, and it continued to melt throughout the warm period. The algae suggests that although the ocean was slower to respond, when it did, it had major implications on sea ice, which fed into global changes in the world's oceans. By comparing this with other research, we're gaining a really exciting new understanding of how the ice in Antarctica behaves and improving predictions of how it will respond to the climate change.
That was Jenny Horrocks from Durham University telling about her research, looking at, really, it's a sort of detective story, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know Jenny terribly well, but there's definitely a personal connection there, and that I love this research of looking into the past to get answers for the future. Leanne was doing a bit of the same. She was looking about 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And Jenny's looking 100,000 years ago. But there's a similar approach, as you said, a detective story.
Yeah.
If we can sort of figure out who the culprits were in the past,
yeah,
we might know what the consequences of their activity will be in the future.
So this research is essential for building accurate models, isn't it? I mean, this brings us on to, I think, really interesting issues about climate denial or the climate change deniers.
That's right.
Because they're claiming that, for example, we've just gone through a very cold period in England in the past week.
Right.
And saying, well, there you go. There's nothing wrong. Everything's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And this past research, it can be manipulated, right? You know, climate deniers will pick up on that type of work that Jenny has done and Leanne and work that I've done and say, well, look, the world was 5 degrees warmer in the past. So clearly what's happening today is just part of natural cycles, which is a bit ridiculous. It's sort of saying, you know, people go into the pub, they get drunk and they fall down. That's just part of a natural cycle. So if I push someone, I'm not responsible for them falling down.
Right.
Right. You know, the real truth is we look in the past to figure out how things work.
Yeah.
And when you explain that to people, it does make them become more confident in models. To be fair, models are fantastic, but they are just models.
Yeah.
When we could tell people that when we look in the past, as Jenny is doing, and she sees very similar, very expected behavior that is consistent with the models, it gives all of us, not just scientists, but I would hope the public and certainly policymakers, more confidence in those models going ahead.
Yeah.
Having said that, she's poking and probing at one of the really, really difficult questions, which is how fast will Antarctica melt?
Yeah.
We look around and we talk about will it melt and will sea level rise be about 1 meter by the end of the century, or a little more, a little bit less. That's not really the question. The question is how fast it's going to melt. That's where the uncertainty comes in. Some people think we might have already locked in 4 or 5 meters of sea level rise based upon the type of work that Jenny is alluding to by looking in the past.
Right.
The question is, how fast will it happen? So when we arbitrarily say, let's look at the year 2100, that's not how much sea level rise is going to happen. That's just how much sea level rise will happen
within that time.
Absolutely.
Wow.
She said right at the beginning, one of the really challenging questions, and it's great to see someone like Jenny tackling this. It's not just how much sea level will rise, it's how quickly.
Right.
That's really what we want to know.
Great.
And think about it in terms of adaptation, right? If sea level rise rises by 20 meters over the next 1,000 years, well, that's better than if it rises that fast over the next 200 years.
Right. Well, look, now, if you heard anything today that really caught your attention or you would like to find out more, then go to the Speakeasy website where you can find the three speakers featured today. And you can drop them a line and invite them to come along to your group or to your school to tell you more about their research. But it just leaves me to say a big thank you to Rich Pankhurst. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And that's all for today. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network, a digital hub for curious minds. Head to cosmicshambles.com for more podcasts, documentaries, blogs, and more from the likes of Robin Ince, Josie Long, Helen Chersky, and Brian Cox, and many, many more. Speakeasy is a platform designed to connect expert speakers with audiences. If you'd like to check out the profiles of any of the people featured in today's show, head over to speakeasy.org. See you all next time.